Could you just speak a little bit about why you decided to do this campaign?
I have personally known Pete Seeger and his work for 60-some-odd years. And I know that as a performer, he has never allowed his integrity to waver when it came to the issues of peace and social justice, civil rights, world stability, the ecology. And those are the large issues, but also he has pointed the way for people to take into account their local conditions, such as the river. He didn't pick any river or all rivers, he picked the Hudson River. And the impetus for this comes from Pete's unwavering integrity. I don't know of anybody else who stimulates us culturally as Pete Seeger has been able to do. In fact, I think that this America that we live in is culturally bereft. It has an economy, it has certain social structures, but we do not have a culture that provides a way in which all people who claim citizenship can feel that they are working towards some common goal. And that's why I feel that music can be put to use to personal satisfaction and social involvement through the arts. I mean, you're asking me a question that has a very, very, very long answer.
Yes, I agree. Why do you think it is that Pete Seeger is not recognized for the incredible amount of social justice and environmental work that he's done over his lifetime?
I think he's recognized, but you see, Pete has a philosophy, and that is that his work as an artist, an entertainer, that performance should not just be used as entertainment, then that the people should be participants, not audience, not spectators. And that the words of a song, for example, move us to action. When he was involved with the civil rights movement and he took the song, "We Shall Overcome," and spread it around the world, it wasn't because it was a cute song. And hundreds of thousands of people took it into their very bloodstream and got up and got out the door and walked in the streets, and nothing that I know of could have moved them to do that because, well, somebody else's job or I have to pay the rent. But there comes a time when you are moved by something that says all of those other things that I do in my day and my year are dependent upon this one aspect of life.
Do you know if there have been any other cases of petitions being carried towards the candidacy for the Nobel Peace Prize?
No, I do not know of any. Because when I started research into the Nobel Peace Prize nomination process, it was hard to find the actual criteria and who gets to be nominated. And it seemed like it was all within the hands of a very small elite. Politicians, I mean, people elected to a legislative body. It says some university professors, but it isn't explicit. At any rate, as I asked questions, I found that the qualifications for a candidate are a candidate's commitment to nonviolent methods, the quality of the candidate as a person of integrity, and sustained contribution to peace. Work on peace, justice, human dignity, and the ecology of the environment. Now, as I read those, I thought there was no more fitting a candidate than Pete. It's been 2 years since mounting this petition on the internet, and there are over 28,000 signatures. And as I say, I have never known that to happen before. To make it a grassroots movement rather than this more elitist kind of. I just pulled up the petition as we're talking, and as of now, the numbers of people who have signed are 28,051.
Wow.
And And almost every one of them has made a comment, so it's not just a signature. It's, this man has turned my world around. I became a singer and songwriter because of Pete Seeger. What a wonderful icon for peace throughout the world. Long overdue. Couldn't find a better recipient. I mean, just on and on and on. Almost 28,000 of these comments. At least four generations of people, because he's 90 years old, have known of Pete's work. And also because when he was blacklisted during the 50s, he couldn't get a job. I was part of that People's Songs, and Pete would go out and play for a union meeting or a group of people for $5. So the only venues that were open to him were summer camps and schools, and I have an ironic sense of humor about that, because if you know the folk tale of Br'er Rabbit saying, "Oh, please, Mr. Fox, don't throw me in the briar patch," and of course the briar patch is the avenue of escape, and Br'er Rabbit had no fear of the briar patch. He only told the fox to do that so that he would. And, in fact, what they did was to throw Pete Seeger in the briar patch and be able that way to expose him to this next generation of children. And it's the children who have carried on this folk revival heritage. And they're the ones that are writing songs, and some of them have been picked up by the music biz. There was Bob Dylan, of course. That's the name, I guess, that jumps to the top of that list. And I don't mean to undermine Bob Dylan's impact, but Pete did something with his work that was unique in that he always used folk song. And that meant not just in a folky, simple, three-chord manner. It meant giving respect and honor to the people in the rural communities from which a lot of this music has come. The Appalachians, the South, the blues. I mean, all of this has a footprint in the folk traditions of the people who have come to this country and have built this country, economically, socially built this country. And wherever Pete had a voice, like at the Newport Folk Music Gathering, it was he, singly, who insisted that people be brought up from the South and from Appalachia to perform in front of this elite, relatively wealthy group of mostly white children who were attending the Newport Folk Festival. And it was mind-blowing, because here were people with the sophistication of music that the classics have. So then when the word folk got picked up by the music biz and applied to people like Bob Dylan, it was completely out of context. It was Pete who said the roots of this, the inspiration for this kind of music, lie in the hills and valleys that you are never going to see. And these people have been keeping this music alive for generations, and they change it each year. I would say it's like the Haggadah at Passover. You know, it's meant to save the history, but you endow it every year with your own experience. And the fact that you are allowed to take the music of the folk and change it to your own conditions has opened it up for the rich heritage that we've experienced of applying light into the recesses of racism and sexism and the other exploitive behavior that we can find in this country.
You were speaking about the blacklistings in the 50s. Do you think that there was a sort of second blacklisting during the Bush administration for people like Pete Seeger?
I think there was something similar, but I don't think that by this time Pete in particular felt it. The Bush years were a terrible time for people to even feel that they could make a change.
I was just thinking because I was listening to a recording of him where he had mentioned that he had not been giving as much mainstream media exposure, and then I was realizing that with his performance at Barack Obama's inauguration concert and with
Oh,
his
yes.
Grammy Award nomination in 2008, it just seemed like things were sort of possibly turning around. I don't know if it was because of the change in administration or not, but I was interested to get your take on that.
Well, of course, now that you bring up the Barack Obama inauguration, yes, that was amazing and absolutely the right thing to do. So the answer to your question is probably yes. The censors are still at it from the 50s. There are still people that would be cut were it not that we are in a different time and place.
So, were you a part of the People's Songs Collective?
Yes.
When did you decide to start making music?
Well, it was a natural for me. My father was a wobbly, so I came up not only in a radical, politically radical family, but the Wobblies were singers. Everybody sang. That was part of their demonstration. And there was a little red songbook. It was made to fit in the pants pocket of a working man, so you could have it with you at all times. It's as big as a billfold. And so the very first things that I learned to sing, congruent with my learning to talk, were out of the little red songbook. And I lived in Greenwich Village, and Pete lived in Greenwich Village. And every Sunday, he'd be there with his banjo, and people would gather around, and we'd have sings in the park. And then I started going there and began to sing. And then it was just a matter of carrying on with that kind of singing wherever I lived. And I became interested in this phenomenon of people getting together around the folk music nucleus. And so I started to produce folk festivals and did one. The first folk festival in Woodstock, New York, was mine, was a real folk festival, not the one they had in 1969. And then we produced one in Atlanta, Georgia, in 65, 66, and 67. And we were just doing what we thought was having fun and singing, and we got a letter from Jimmy Carter, who was then the governor, thanking us so much for peacefully integrating the Georgia State Park, which was a nice acknowledgement, but it was not our intention. I mean, the paradox was that when you sing together with a bunch of people, you are all people. You don't make separations between color or even nationality. So it accomplished what it was meant to do, but in doing what it was meant to do, it accomplished a greater good, which was to integrate the Georgia State Park.
Do you remember any really memorable or moving singings or experiences with the People's Songs Collective?
Well, certainly the Progressive Party was a highlight. Yeah, but you see, after 1948, after the demise of the Progressive Party, People's Songs was more or less folded too. They put out a little journal called Sing Out, which is still going on, but it's a much more slick magazine. It's really a magazine now. But people in small groups, for example, the Atlanta Folk Music Society that I was part of, took its model from the People's Song. When I came out to California, I helped with a group and developed something called the Freedom Song Network, and that definitely has its model with People's Songs. And again, it's people who sing and write and perform songs that can be used by working people and poor people to focus light on the kinds of problems that they're facing.
Do you remember any specific performances or concerts, though, that were particularly emotionally moving?
See, there was one at Carnegie Hall that was pretty good. at the height, I think it was 60, God, it was 67. At any rate, the movement had become so big that there were hundreds of songwriters and individuals and groups that were performing around the country. And we, I don't know who exactly who was that rented Carnegie Hall, but they gave a concert that lasted all night long. And everybody who was involved in that movement, it was not the big name. It was just people who were singing in this vein, the vein of social justice. Everybody was invited to come and do a performance at Carnegie Hall, and I will never forget it. I followed the Fugs. Now, I don't know if you know the Fugs, but they were one of the first off-the-wall, in-your-face, fuck-you kind of groups. And certainly, they were allowed 20 minutes to do a set, and they spent 20 minutes tuning. And the audience was going crazy, you know, get off the stage, boo, if there had been eggs, they would have thrown them. Finally, they did one little piece and got off the stage. And I was supposed to follow this group. So I thought, okay, you got to do something. And I don't play a guitar. My husband was the musician, and then we broke up, and I lost the accompaniment. And so I walked out on the stage of Carnegie Hall, which can look like the North American continent when you're one little person going out there. And I stood in the front of the stage, and I looked all around. And then I told my little story about having read in the New York Times a piece about how the children in public school should be indoctrinated for in the event of an atomic attack on this country. And the language that they used was that the children in kindergarten to third grade should have it made part of their creative play, you know, hiding under the desk and putting your arms over your head as a way of saving yourself from nuclear blast. And I thought the language of that was so outrageous and ironic that I wrote a song, and the song was called Bomb's Lullaby. So I sang my little song, and I got a standing ovation at Carnegie Hall. Yeah. Anyway, it was a highlight. You asked for a highlight. There was one.
I would say that's a highlight.
Yeah.
So, did you get to see the Almanac Singers perform?
The Almanacs, I knew some of the people in that group, but they were a little bit before the time I'm talking about, because I'm talking about 1947, 48.
Okay.
And then the Weavers were formed in 1949. And at that time, I was living with Lee Hayes and some other people in New York City. And Lee Hayes was the bass in the Weavers. So they were always at the house. I knew of their forming. And Lee asked me if I would like to be part of that group. And at that time, I was too young and stupid and said, oh, no, I'm not good enough to be part of that group. So Ronnie Gilbert got the job.
Wow.
That I was good enough and I should have known it.
Is that something that you regret?
Yeah. That was just a stupid, childish. I didn't have enough ego and didn't have enough self-confidence, or I should have done that.
Do you remember any specific occasions during that period of time?
I think the model for the things that we had at the house, and also at Pete's house, was that folks just dropped in. It was like having a house party. Part of this movement for the Nobel Prize for Pete is that we have been sponsoring what we call For Pete's Sake Sing, which was to stimulate people to have groups get together and to sing on Pete's 90th birthday, which is May 3rd. The idea came from a woman in Melbourne, Australia, and I said, great, let's go with it. So between her and my group, there are I know of about 20. And if I know 20, there must be 20 more groups of people around this country and in Australia, in Copenhagen, in Stockholm, in Vancouver, that have contacted me that said, yes, we're going to get a group together, and we're going to just get a bunch of local musicians, and we will have a birthday party called For Pete's Sake Sing. And this goes back to my influence by Pete and those folks back in the time that we've just been talking about.
You were hoping to achieve a nomination for Pete by 2008, which didn't work out. So when do you think a nomination will be possible in the future?
Okay, he has been nominated for this year, for 2009.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is, I mean, now we're getting down to brass tacks here. Yes, it was Barbara Lee, who is the congressional representative from the 9th District of California, which is Berkeley, and where I live. So that's already been done. We are still looking for other nominators for next year, given that Pete is alive. I don't intend to quit until he is no longer alive, because they don't award the prize posthumously. So as long as he's alive, we'll keep trying to find other nominators. Somebody from the consul told me that the more nominators, the better. So we've got these 28,000 so far petition nominators, and we have to find somebody who has, you know, the standing that they require and keep going.
And so when do you find out if he was selected or not for this year?
In October. They don't announce before October.
Well, here's hoping.
Yeah.
Is there a number of signatures that you think would put you over the edge of having enough influence to get more support?
That's hard to say, because it's a unique kind of approach. Would they be more inclined to think that 50,000 were better? I don't know. I just am going to see that the petition keeps going. One of the problems is that Pete is not somebody who likes to be honored. He is very self-deprecating in a way, you know. Although he's got all of these qualities of exciting people to do things. If you talk about recognizing him, he becomes very reticent, and he doesn't like the idea of this Nobel Prize thing being a big deal. So,
well, he's very modest.
He's modest to a fault, almost.
When did you first start thinking about wanting to do this? Was it just the Nobel Peace Prize, or was it achieving more recognition for his work in general?
The idea of the Nobel was that little click that you hear when something takes off. We were talking about, geez, somebody should nominate Pete Seeger for the Nobel Peace Prize, and there was the click. So much of what I have done in my life has been influenced by Pete, and most people in my generation are not friendly with the computer, and I am. And I thought, my God, you know, we could get a petition going on the internet. And I found a really good site. It's called Petition Them. The kinds of petitions that were on there were very progressive. And so I mounted this petition and started getting thousands of signatures, and I just was delighted. And then it grew. Then it grew into sending around flyers, and then it grew into having bumper stickers printed. You know, then it grew to this song contest. And fortunately, I am retired, so I can spend 9 to 5 every day in front of my computer doing this kind of work.
When did you first start building the website for the campaign?
This whole thing started 2 years ago in March. So we're in 2007. So we have a small committee of 5 people who work on this project.
And what is it that you think is the way that Pete has influenced your work and your life the most?
Personal integrity. He is a model, and that's, again, why his doing this work is important, because I think we have so few models of personal integrity, the consistency that he represents. And it's certainly something that I learned from my father, who was in the IWW, and I think had the same kind of commitment to not changing his political position with the winds of political change. So, yes, it has to do with Pete's personal intake.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me and for spearheading such a great project.
Yeah, so you're very welcome. I enjoyed reminiscing.